Well, happy New Year to everyone. It's good to be back and meet with you. We were in 3rd John back in December. My view of 2nd and 3rd John is that they were actually written prior to 1st John. The order of books in the New Testament was not there was no need to come up with an order to put them into books, that is, into a complete binding, until the 4th century. In the 4th century, two things came together that made it so that an entire Bible could be put in one binding. Prior to that, if you had a volume that included Luke and John, it exceeded the actual technical capability of the codex. That what would happen with a book even of that short a length is that the binding at the middle of the volume and at the end of the volume, the outside and the inside both would start failing. So they would lose pages at the beginning of the portion that had been bound together, pages at the end, and pages in the very middle. But in the 4th century, there were two technological features that came about that made it so that all of a sudden it became possible to put together an entire Bible. Not just a portion of the New Testament, but an entire Bible, Old and New Testament, could be put together. As a result of that, it was during the 4th century that people started becoming concerned about the order in which books would appear. And it was at that time that an order was settled upon of 1 John, 2 John, and 3 John. One of the features that tended to be important during the era of manuscripts was that it was easier to fit shorter books in later than earlier. That is, you wanted to have your big books first. It's sort of like some of you may remember, this dates me, when you would play with Lincoln Logs and then you had to put all of the things back into the box, the container, which was shaped sort of like a Quaker Oats container. You had to put the long ones in first, then you could have put in the small ones. If you put the small ones in first, you would never get the long ones in. So in a very similar way, there's a tendency within the New Testament to join books according to genre, author, and length, going from longest to shortest. And the epistles of John ended up being 1 John, probably because it was the longest, and then 2 and 3 John later. But I would argue that 1 John was actually the third of them that was written. The feature that points to that is that in 2 John, verse 12, John says, "Having many things to write to you, I did not wish to do so with paper," actually, papyrus, "and ink, but hope to come to you and speak face to face that our joy may be full." So the issue there is it seems that he may have been delayed longer than he had expected and needed to write a longer letter in order to cover the bases. That longer letter, I believe, was 1 John. And the outline features between 2 John and 1 John is that 1 John is essentially an expansion of 2 John. I think 3 John also fits within that same picture. One of the things that John mentions is that he had sent another letter, a letter that is not preserved for us, to the church, but one of the elders there was unwilling to receive it. So, I think all of this points to a tapestry in which 1 John was the final puzzle piece. So let's do a quick review of what we had considered last time back in December. In verses 2 through 4, John prays for Gaius because of his reception of the apostles and their emissaries. And then the second part that we covered, verses 5 through 8, John talks about how Gaius is faithful to believers, whether he knows them or not. And so he's urging him to continue to do so that he might share in the reward of these who minister in Christ's name that refuse to accept financial support from Gentiles, specifically Gentile unbelievers. So, with that, now John gets to the problem. The problem is the reason that he has written this letter specifically. And so that starts in verse 9. We have a Diotrephes versus Demetrius here in this section. So in verse 9, John wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who seems to be one of the elders at this congregation, does not receive the apostles or their emissaries because he seeks preeminence among the elders. That's verse 9. And so he says in verse 9, I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, does not receive us. So the letter written to the church would have been intercepted by Diotrephes, and he doesn't receive us. That is, he doesn't listen to us. He doesn't take us seriously. He would have disposed of the letter. It probably did not reach the congregation, and so forth. I'm letting you know about this, and he's going to have more to say about that. I'd like to do a digression at this point, and that would be to talk about New Testament leadership as it was constituted in the first century. That in this set of notes will be on the third page. And so for this, we're going to turn to 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 17. That passage has a few details that make it one of the clearest passages on the structure of New Testament church government. There's an interesting feature here that has not tended to be noticed. And so the text reads, "Let the elders who rule well be considered worthy of a double honorarium." This is talking about financial compensation. Especially those who labor in the word and teaching. Now, an interesting feature about this passage is it gives us indication that there should be a two-way grid in order to understand this passage. And I have a chart here on the notes. Notice we have four groups, four possible permutations of how these people come together. Those who rule well, and in addition to that, they labor in the word and teaching. Down below that, there would be those who rule well, but do not labor in the word and teaching. Then moving to the right column, those who do not rule well, but labor in the word and teaching. And then finally, those who neither rule well nor labor in the word and teaching. So we have four possible permutations as to how people would arrange out of this. Let's read the verse once again. Let the elders who rule well, that's implying that there are elders who don't rule well. Let the ones who rule well be considered worthy of a double honorarium, especially those who labor in the word and teaching. So there would be some who labor in the word and teaching and some who don't. That's quite clear when he says especially those who do this, but also Secondarily, consider those who rule well worthy of a double honorarium, even those who don't labor in the word and teaching. Now you'll notice that I have boxes 1 and 4 grayed out. That's because they are quite self-evident. It would be easy to see why those who rule well and labor in the word and teaching should especially be worthy of a double honorarium. And it would be quite clear that those who do neither, group number 4, who neither rule well nor do they labor in the word and teaching, it's quite evident that they wouldn't be considered worthy of a double honorarium. So let's ignore groups 1 and 4, those who do both and those who do neither. So what we're going to concentrate on is groups 2 and 3. And the reason for that is that the structure that many churches have for their leadership creates an interesting problem with this verse. Many churches have what can be called the Baptist model. Now, when I call it the Baptist model, it's just because they're famous for it. Many other churches have the same structure. If you have a church that has one pastor who could also be called the one and only elder of that church, and then there are deacons, but there's only one elder, and that one elder is the pastor, that's the Baptist model. So I'm not picking on Baptists. It just is a convenient title. There are many churches from various denominations and independent churches as well that have this model. There's one elder, he's called the pastor, and then there's a deacon board. Then there are a couple of other models that have a plurality of elders. There's the Presbyterian model, and there's going to be the Brethren model. Now, the Presbyterian Church is not the only church that uses this model, but guess what the word Presbyterian means? The Greek word for elder is presbyteros. So Presbyterian means an elderian, an elder type government. It's only one of the types of plurality of elder model, but we'll talk about it first. The Presbyterian model has a teaching elder, normally called the pastor, but then it has elders other than the teaching pastor, and it may also have a deacon board. So elders have one set of responsibilities, deacons have a different set of responsibilities, but there's a plurality of elders. They have one pastor, but the pastor is an elder. Normally he's an elder. But in any event, there's a plurality of elders with one teaching pastor, and with other elders who are not regularly in the pulpit. That's one of the plurality of elders models. There is another plurality of elders model, and that's called the Brethren model. And Brethren congregations normally do not have one pastor. And the teaching responsibilities as well as the leadership or ruling responsibilities are shared among the elders. Now, for the purposes of what we're going to talk about, The Presbyterian model is the one that ends up being the easiest to say complete correlation with what 1 Timothy 5:17 presupposes, but the brethren model of plurality of elders can be argued for as well. But the Baptist model that only has one elder runs into an interesting problem. Now, let's review what we've seen. You'll notice on that chart that there's up in the northwest corner, group one, that both rules well and labors in the word and teaching. They do both. Obviously, they are especially to be considered worthy of a double honorarium. Then we have the group in the southeast corner, group number four, who do neither. They don't rule well and they don't labor in the word and teaching. We're excluding those. And now what we're doing is we're looking to see what Paul says about groups two and three. Does it fit better with one of the types of church government that we see today? In other words, when people argue for how they structure the government of their church, as to whether it has more than one elder or it has only one elder, they tend to do that based upon what their denomination says. They will attempt to have a constitution that's in keeping with whatever state that they are incorporated under, and they will attempt to be in keeping with what the Bible teaches. But this is a verse that has gone under the radar. What I'm going to talk about here, I have written on, if anyone wants to read an article where I go through this in depth, you can email me and we can send a link to that article. Groups two and three create difficulties. Now, group number two, looking at the chart, they are in the southwest corner. They rule well, but they do not labor in the word and teaching. But what does the passage say for considering worthy of the double honorarium? Those who rule well. Now, it was especially those who also labored in the word and teaching. But ones who do not labor in the word and teaching, but rule well, are to be considered worthy of double honorarium. So now, let's look at group number three. What about those who don't rule well, but they labor in the word and teaching? You say, well, how much time does someone put into ruling functions of the church? Versus how much time goes into preparing messages so that there can be an accurate understanding of the Word of God coming forth in every session where teaching is going on within a church? Laboring is a word that means laboring to exhaustion. And so, does it not seem odd? Now, we're assuming for the moment there's only one elder in a congregation. They say, wow, the most important qualification for deciding how much should we compensate this man is, does he rule well? Not, does he spend enough time in the scripture to know what he's talking about? Now, if that sounds backwards, you're absolutely right. Paul is saying here, The big qualification is how the person rules. And as a secondary consideration, how much time and how hard he works on wrestling with the word and wrestling with his teaching to make sure that he's communicating truth in an understandable way. This passage creates a real problem, because that is, if one assumes there's only one elder in a congregation. This model would set forth the idea that how much time and how hard the elder works at preparing messages to make sure that it's accurate and understandable is really not all that important. Well, guess what? In my assessment, I've seen a lot of churches where I don't think that they think it's all that important. But would we imagine that Paul would say it's not all that important? Absolutely not. So let's now consider this from a different standpoint. What happens if the Presbyterian model is right? The Presbyterian model says that there are ruling elders, and there's a teaching elder who also is supposed to rule. So the rulership function is held by the entire elder board. So all elders are expected to rule well. But one is going to devote his time during the week to preparing messages and making sure that they're accurate and understandable. So in that model, Paul is not saying, oh, wow, there are some elders who are really falling down on their job because they're not laboring in the word and teaching. Now let's think about this back in the first century, or let's think about it in a third world country today. Is a small congregation in a third world country today, or is a small congregation in the first century going to be able to support the teaching elders to such an extent that the teaching elder does not need to work outside at all? Not likely. Remember, even Paul made tents. And Paul received support from people beyond one individual congregation. Remember Philippi, they were sending him money on a regular basis to keep him functioning. But individual pastors normally had to work outside of ministry in order to make a living. Just as many pastors with small congregations need to work outside in order that there's enough money to keep the building functioning and so forth. The double honorarium is not talking about full salary. What he's talking about is paying the pastor generously for the amount of time that he's putting into the study, making it so that he can afford to work a little less in pursuits other than preparing for ministry to the congregation and conducting church-related ministry. Under the Presbyterian model, what we have is a number of elders. All of them are expected to have ruling ability. They need to make decisions on the governance, on the functioning, on the policies, when discipline needs to be exercised, all of those types of things. The teaching elder has a role in that. But he also is the one who, on a week to week to week basis, is the one who is normally carving out the time to prepare messages in the Word. So the plurality of elders model fits the specifics of this passage. And the singular elder model does not. It really runs into a problem. Paul is not rebuking those who don't labor in the Word and teaching. It's not part of their responsibility. Laboring, as I pointed out, is working to exhaustion. It's the person putting his seat in the chair, his nose in the book, and wrestling through the passages, making sure that he knows what is there and how to communicate it well. The teaching elder has a dual role. He's expected to labor in the Word and teaching, which is uniquely his responsibility. So therefore, they need to be concerned, since his time is going into that, making it so that he doesn't have time to work in the fields or operate a butcher business or whatever, that he's compensated. But elders who rule well were expected to be compensated also. Now clearly, they were not being compensated to such an extent that they didn't need to have another job on the side. But elders who ruled well would be considered worthy of a double honorarium. Doesn't mean necessarily that all congregations were able to afford to pull that off, but they were to be considered worthy of it. And the double honorarium means to be generous. So, under this, it does make sense that Paul is talking about a plurality of elders. And I would argue that every passage that discusses the issue can be, that discusses the issue or mentions elders, they tend to be mentioned in the plural, which of course those who argue for only one elder per congregation say, well, there may have been multiple congregations within an individual city and so on and so forth. All of these things are possible ways of explaining most passages. But this passage is one that points to a plurality of elders within congregations as Paul's expectation. The notion of teaching elders who are ruling and teaching, and of ruling elders who their exclusive role normally would be for ruling, functioning at the board level. Now, obviously, they may be teaching on occasion. Now, I did mention at the back of the notes that sometimes people mention 1 Timothy 3:2 as a possible objection, where the normal translation is that one of the qualifications for an elder or an overseer is that they are to be apt to teach. That's understanding that adjective, the word is didaktikos in Greek, that's understanding it as an active verbal adjective. I'm going to coin a term. It's not a real term. It won't show up in any dictionary, but it makes it easy to catch the difference between understanding this actively and understanding it passively. I'm going to create a term. The way that people understand didacticos typically is teachable, able to teach. But we're making it into one word, teachable. I believe that it should be understood as a passive, teachable. The qualifications that are given, none of them are skill related, but they are related to proper exercise of biblical decorum or character traits. And being teachable is a trait, whereas to be able to teach would be a skill. And I think that within the context, Paul is aiming at elders needing to be teachable. Now, if one is teachable and has been taught, that person has content that they could communicate. How strong their teaching ability is, in all probability, not a person who had no teaching ability probably wouldn't be considered for a leadership role, because it's necessary to be able to say what position he holds, as there is discussion over what does this passage mean, how should it be implemented, and he should be able to explain himself and to make a case for his understanding. That would be an ability to teach. He may not do so on a normal basis, but being teachable is an even more important trait, because it means that he can be critiqued by the word, and he can be critiqued by fellow believers who know the word. Okay, so let's look again at verse 9. John wrote to the church a letter that has not been preserved, but Diotrephes does not receive the apostles or their emissaries because he seeks preeminence among the elders. That is, he seeks to rule things, and he's not going to listen to his fellow elders. He's not going to listen to the apostle John. So that letter probably went into the circular file. As a result, John writes now to Gaius. Gaius is the addressee of this letter. So, verse 10. In light of Diotrephes not receiving John or his emissaries, John will recount in a trial. When he comes to town, there's going to be a reckoning. He is going to deal with Diotrephes' tattling gossip against the apostles, his refusal to receive apostolic emissaries, and his excommunicating those who receive those emissaries, if and when John comes. So verse 10, therefore, if I come, and he's expecting he will, I will call to mind his deeds which he does, prating against us with malicious words, and not content with that, he does not receive the brethren, and forbids those who wish to, putting them out of the church. So he's running the place as a dictator. He isn't allowing anyone to critique him. Not the Lord, not the apostles, not his fellow elders. And John says, there will be a reckoning. I wrote the letter to the church. It's probably been disposed of. It certainly hasn't reached out to everybody like it was supposed to. But I'm going to come and I'm going to deal with it. And Diotrephes is the one who's going to be excommunicated. Now, do we see anywhere in this letter that John is saying that Diotrephes is an unbeliever? No. No indication of that. It just says he's on a power trip. And his power isn't going to last very long. John's going to deal with it. And instead of Diotrephes calling the shots, it's going to be John and the Lord calling the shots. So then, in verse 11, John instructs Gaius not to imitate Diotrephes' evil, but he should imitate what is good, because the one who does good is of God, but the one who does evil has not seen God. Now, Gaius isn't in a position to take over and start excommunicating people and kicking people out and so on and so forth. But what he's saying is, Diotrephes is doing a lot of things in the wrong way, and don't you imitate him by standing for truth by doing what's wrong. Stand for truth in keeping with truth. Now, what is the most particular way that John wants Diotrephes to, wants Gaius to conduct himself? Within this letter, he talks about how he, well, let's go back to verse 5. Beloved Gaius, you do faithfully whatever you do for the brethren and for strangers who have borne witness of your love before the church. If you send them forward on their journey in a manner worthy of God, you will do well, because they went forth for his name's sake, taking nothing from the Gentiles. These are the apostolic emissaries that he's also mentioned of in verse 10. Look back in the middle of verse 10. That Diotrephes is not content with maligning the apostles, but he also does not receive the brethren. These are emissaries sent out by John. They are emissaries who are not reliant upon contributions from Gentile unbelievers, but they are instead functioning within the budget of what the Lord has provided to underwrite the apostolic ministry and those that are associated with it. And they're not in it for the dime. They're not in it trying to get ahead in improper ways. They're relying on God for his support. They're relying upon people providing them places to stay as they're traveling, doing ministry on behalf of John or the other apostles. And Gaius has put these people up, fed them, and even possibly sent them off with an offering to help them along the way to their next city. And John is saying, these people have been treated badly by Diotrephes. And John seems to be somewhat delayed, as we've indicated from comparing 2 John and 1 John and looking especially at 2 John verse 12. John was expecting to come back quickly. It seems that he's delayed. And what he's telling Gaius is, I want you to continue doing what you have done as emissaries have come through. Put them up, feed them, send them on their way. If you're able to make a contribution, great. Continue doing that. That's your role. Did he say, I want you to get out and start undermining Diotrephes? No, he hasn't said to do that. He's given him permission, and he has urged him to continue doing what he has done. He's reassured Gaius, I'm planning to come. I am going to deal with the situation when I come, but I want you to continue doing what you're doing. What you're doing is good. Now, obviously, if John is delayed and he sends some emissaries, those emissaries are going to have ability to deal with some of the things that Diotrephes puts up and so on and so forth. They would be commissioned by John to take care of certain things. But Gaius is to make sure that he does things in a godly way. And he has a particular responsibility, and that is to assist those that John sends through. So that brings us now to verse 12. Gaius should receive one particular emissary, Demetrius, who has a good testimony from the brethren, from the apostles, and from the truth as God's representative. Now, I can't prove this, but it seems reasonable, in light of this being a fairly short letter, that Demetrius may be the emissary that is carrying this letter. In other words, I don't think that John is saying, oh, someday Demetrius will come, and when he comes, send him along on his way, put him up, and so forth. It is John saying, here's Demetrius. I have a task for him. You can assist. You just take care of Demetrius's needs as he's here in town with you. And he's going to conduct himself. He's going to take care of things. He's probably going to be dealing with Demetrius. With Diotrephes. I can tell. You're going to have to sort through. I'm going to have the three people's names, Gaius, Demetrius, and Diotrephes, mixed up here and there. But you get the point. So, now that John has introduced his representative, who's going to deal with things, and with Gaius knowing what he should do, that he's supposed to take care of Demetrius and allow Demetrius to do what he needs to do there, then he gives his farewell. So that's in verses 13 and 14. John had much to write to Gaius, but prefers speaking over writing because he expects to travel to meet with him shortly. So he says, once again, I'm expecting to come fairly soon, so when I do, I'll be able to fill you in on more details. But I'm just covering the bases right here. I have much that I'd love to say to you. I should be there to see you soon. And so then in 14b, friends that are with John greet Gaius, and Gaius is to greet friends that John knows there personally. Now the word for friend is philos. And you probably have heard sermons especially in John 21, about the supposed strong difference between philos and agape. Both words are translated very often love. But I would argue that we don't see a strong distinguishing of these terms. Notice in John chapter 20, verse 2, says, then she ran and came to Simon Peter and to the other disciple, whom, singular, Jesus loved, and the term here is phileo, and said to him, they have taken away the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have laid him. But in John 13, 23, now there was leaning on Jesus' chest, one of his disciples, whom Jesus loved. And the verb there is agapao. So notice, same phrase in English, the one whom Jesus loved, but it can be rendering either phileo or agapao. John does not strongly distinguish these terms. Let's now turn to 1 Thessalonians. And I would argue that Paul doesn't sharply distinguish these terms either. First Thessalonians chapter 4. This is my speaking Bible. I don't turn its pages a lot. I have another Bible I use all the time. This one doesn't turn pages much, so it's hard to turn the pages. Chapter 4, verse 9 in 1 Thessalonians. But concerning brotherly love, Philadelphos, the name of the city that's mentioned in Revelation, and the name of the city in Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, derives from this term. But notice, philos is part of it. But concerning brotherly love, and the word adelphos is the word brother, so that's the reason New King James has translated it brotherly love. You have no need that I should write to you, for the idea is because you yourselves are taught by God to love, agapao, one another. So notice within the one sentence, he's able to interchange between phileo and agapao. There's not a sharp distinction between these terms. So people are called beloved. And notice that in the beginning of the book, he says to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth, and so forth. Not a strong distinction between terms, and he speaks of the friends, and he's using the word philos. These are terms that they do not have a distinction that people tend to make, a sharp distinction. On the bottom of page 2, I give other places where the New Testament says that individual elders are not supposed to try to gain preeminence over the other elders, but that the concept that's understood within the New Testament is a plurality of elders within each congregation. And so these various passages do give indication of that. Notice that we just talked about 3 John verses 9 and 10, but in 1 Peter 2, Y'all, plural, shepherd the flock, singular of God among y'all. That would seem to point to elders within a congregation, a flock, and that's suggesting a plurality of elders within congregations. Obviously, those who hold to a Baptist model have ways that they would respond, but as we've indicated, the real passage that has to be discussed is how to make sense of 1 Timothy 5:17, which we've covered. Then in Luke's writings, we have Acts 14:23. They appointed elders, plural, in every church, singular. Acts 20:17, from Miletus, he sent to Ephesus and called for the elders, plural, of the church, singular, the church at Ephesus. Acts 20:28, take heed to yourselves, plural, and to all the flock among which God has made you overseers. An overseer, that's the word episkopos, but it is a comparable concept to the elder, to shepherd the church, singular, of God.